This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick today. I'm Dave Davies. The Major League Baseball All-Star Game was last night. Going into the second half of the season, the Oakland A's are second behind Seattle in the American League West. When Michael Lewis started researching his book, Moneyball, he had a simple question. How did the A's, a motley collection of baseball misfits and utility players with the second lowest payroll in all of baseball, win so many games? The answer lies, as it often does in baseball, with statistics, but in this case a very creative and unusual use of statistical analysis on the part of the A's general manager, Billy Bean. Bean paid attention to numbers collected over the years by a group of baseball enthusiasts, including software engineers, physics professors, and Wall Street analysts, numbers that most everyone else in baseball ignores. These stats enabled Bean to discern the unique talents of undervalued players no one else wanted. He then assembled and regrouped them on the field, eventually pulling together a winning team last year. Michael Lewis followed the A's through the 2002 season. Terry spoke to Lewis at the beginning of this baseball season and asked him to talk about the prevailing wisdom that teams with the most money to spend on players win the most games.
Well, the American League West, which has Oakland, the Seattle Mariners, the Anaheim Angels, and the Texas Rangers in it, finished in exact inverse relation to the amount of money the team spent on players. I think Oakland spent $40 million and won 103 games. Anaheim won a few games less and spent $20 million more. Seattle won a few games less than that and spent $20 million more than Anaheim. And Texas won 20 or 30 games less than everybody, and they spent, I don't know, $110, $115 million of some vast sum of money. So that was anybody who believed that money bought success in baseball would have been perplexed by how the American League West finished.
You attribute a lot of the Oakland A's success to its general manager, Billy Bean. What kind of shape was the team in when he took over the team?
It was a losing team when he took over in 1997. And it's gotten better every year under his stewardship. And Billy Bean came into the organization and embraced the idea that there was such a thing as new knowledge in baseball, and you could research baseball and find out interesting things about it by researching it, and that the way baseball teams were conventionally run had all sorts of inefficiencies in it that could be exploited for profit. And so you've got essentially one team that's living purely by its wits and making a good run of it.
So the new knowledge, as you put it, that he was trying to find or to create in baseball was based in part on new baseball statistics and new ways of measuring the performance of players. What made him look at statistics more carefully and look for new ways of creating statistics?
Well, his predecessor in the job at Oakland, a fellow named Sandy Alderson, who's now works in the commissioner's office, had discovered Bill James, the baseball writer, who in the late 70s and early 80s published a series of what he called abstracts, where he systematically challenged the conventional wisdom of baseball, the traditional way baseball was played on the field, the traditional way of ways of evaluating baseball players. And while the Oakland A's have not sort of aped Bill James and taken everything he said and applied it to their system, they embraced the idea that's sort of central to James's work, that just because everybody does it a certain way doesn't mean it's right, and that you can use statistics to sort of dig below the surface of baseball and find the hidden game and find attributes, for example, in players that are very important but not highly valued in the marketplace, and also find attributes in players that teams pay a lot for that actually aren't worth that much when it comes to victory and defeat.
What are some of the Bill James statistical creations that changed the thinking of the A's?
Well, as I say, it's the spirit of James more than the specifics, but in his early works, James does something, you know, would seem commonsensical. He builds a model, a statistical model, to explain where runs come from. You know, how important is a walk or a single or a double or a triple in creating runs? And what he would do is take all the singles and doubles and triples and walks that, say, the Boston Red Sox in 1975 had and try to figure out and try to predict how many runs the Boston Red Sox would score on the basis of that. And so he developed this predictive model that was actually quite good. I mean, he could see that he could see what how important these offensive attributes were, these offensive statistics were. And he quickly came to the conclusion that batting average, for example, which is held out, was maybe the chief way to evaluate the effectiveness of a hitter, was less important than on-base percentage. And the big difference between batting average and on-base percentage is how often a player walks. And so that the Oakland A's take this, and they go out and look for players who walk a lot but don't have gaudy batting averages. So they aren't very expensive, but they generate this thing that's very valuable called on-base percentage. But an awful lot of what the Oakland A's do is actually now proprietary to the Oakland A's. They sort of embraced the spirit of James, and they created their own kind of research and development program within the organization to generate proprietary information.
Why don't you describe how one of the players signed to the Oakland A's became a big success with the A's but hadn't been thought of as a great player before joining the A's?
There are plenty of examples, but let's take one of the characters in the book, Scott Hatterberg. Scott Hatterberg had spent 10 years in the Boston Red Sox organization, four of them in the minor leagues and I guess almost six of them in the big leagues. He'd been a catcher. And the Red Sox viewed him as a catcher who, you know, wasn't a disaster as a hitter. And that was because they didn't value what he did really well. What he did really well was he got on base way above the major league, at a rate way above the big league average, which is the single most important thing that a player can do. And in addition, and this is a more subtle virtue in a hitter, each of his plate appearances were inordinately drawn out. He would always see more pitches per plate appearance than just about any player in the league. And he rarely swung at pitches that were out of the strike zone. Now, the effect of this is to subtly wear down the opposing pitching. It's good for the team to have a team full of guys who don't swing at balls and who force the opposing pitcher to throw lots of pitches. But it's even better to have a team full of guys who get on base a lot. Anyway, the Oakland A's had seen these qualities in Scott Hatterberg because they measured things like the number of pitches he saw per plate appearance, and they watched very closely for on-base percentage. And so they had been for several years praying that they could some way get their hands on Scott Hatterberg. Well, Scott Hatterberg had an accident during spring training with the Boston Red Sox and ruptured a nerve in his throwing elbow, and it basically meant he couldn't feel his hand. He had to relearn how to throw the baseball. He was finished from that moment on as a catcher, because you have to be able to throw as a catcher. And the Red Sox then tossed him on the scrap heap. They had no sense that he was valuable as a hitter. Well, Scott Hatterberg ends up becoming a free agent, and no one wants him. I mean, it's actually extraordinary. He becomes a free agent, I think it's 2 days before Christmas at midnight. And at 12:01, Paul DePodesta, the assistant GM of the Oakland A's, is on the phone to his agent saying, "We got to have this guy." And as his agent said, "Look, we were looking at a market where 29 teams regarded Scott as useless. And one team desperately wanted him." So Hatterberg became the first baseman of the Oakland A's last year. And he's been terrific. He's been a subtle but extremely important offensive player. And the reason they got him is that no one else saw the value in him. And because no one else saw the value in him, he was cheap. They didn't have to pay him very much. And you know, but to get back to, just to finish off the thought of about Scott Hatterberg, that what to me what was great about this story, as I say, is that you have this collection of junkyard dogs, these underdogs that nobody else wanted, coming together to be a really great team. And often what was valuable about them as baseball players was hidden to the wider world. There was traits that were discerned by the Oakland front office that other people hadn't seen, but they were often also character traits. I mean, one of the questions, that's sort of the open question that they discuss often in the Oakland front office, is whether this quality that Scott Hatterberg had, or has, plate discipline, they call it, which is so important in an offensive player, whether it's can be taught or whether it's in some way innate. And Billy Bean, the general manager of the Oakland Aces, come to the conclusion that it's innate, that basically, unless they could get a guy in diapers, by the time they become professional baseball players, they're almost hardwired to approach hitting the way they approach hitting. So the question I had when I, you know, get to know Scott Hatterberg and spend some time in his life is, what is it about him that makes him so patient, that makes him so disciplined and composed when he's in the batter's box, which in turn leads to his value. And this wonderful stuff comes out of it. When I would spend an hour before every game with him reviewing tape of his performances and of the pitchers he was about to face. And there was one tape where he's facing a pitcher from the Seattle Mariners named Jamie Moyer. And he's already seen seven or eight pitches. There's a full count, and he's fouling off pitches. And Jamie Moyer, in disgust, steps off the mound and shouts something to him. And I said, what on earth is that about? And he said, well, it's a little weird, he said. But he was asking me what I wanted. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, just tell me what you want, and I'll throw it. That he was, his approach to hitting absolutely frustrated opposing pitchers because everything he did, he drew out their encounter for far too long in the eyes of the opposing pitchers. And I spent an awful lot of time just trying to get to the bottom of what it was inside of Scott Hatterberg that led him to do this.
And did you think you figured it out?
I think I figured out that what it was inside of him had been inside of him since he was a little boy. Because since he was a little boy, baseball coaches, little league baseball coaches, high school baseball coaches, college baseball coaches, they try to beat out of him this valuable approach. There is this strain of thinking in the game that if you're going to be a great hitter, you have to be aggressive. And people are always screaming at him to swing at things he didn't want to swing at. And he took refuge in a tape that the Yankees' famous first baseman, Don Mattingly, had made when Hatterberg was a boy. It was a tape called How to Hit 300. And on this tape, Mattingly explains that it's important to be patient at the plate, that drawing lots of walks is a good thing for a hitter, that swinging at things that you can't hit hard, even if they're strikes, is a bad idea. This was the one thing that Hatterberg heard as a young baseball player that gave him the courage of his conviction. But he wanted to believe it anyway. It was, he said, I've always felt uncomfortable, swinging at the first pitch. I need to slow the game down before I can really play it. And I've always thought, another time he said, even when I was a little kid, when I'd swing at something that, you know, I really couldn't hit hard, and I ground out to second base. It just struck me as a worthless experience, and it was an insistence that the game conform to his idea of what it should be. That to slow the game down, to kind of give it a kind of meaning.
You know, in talking about how Billy Bean signs new players, he gives you his rules for a shopping spree. What are some of his rules?
The first and most important rule, violated by many, many teams in big league baseball, is that the minute you feel like you have to do something, you're screwed. That you can always recover from the player you didn't sign, but you may never recover from the player that you did sign that you shouldn't have. And baseball is littered with teams that have signed putative superstars to huge contracts who then don't pan out. And the franchises are wounded or sometimes severely crippled by the fact that they don't have any money left to go and pay other players. And they're left with a superstar who's not performing and earning $80 million. In baseball, it makes much less sense to do this than in most sports because one guy on a baseball team rarely makes that much difference. It really is a team sport. So the notion that you've got to sign this superstar or that superstar is really a little silly. And that's the first principle of Billy Bean's School of Management.
What's another one of his rules?
Number two is identify exactly who you want and go and get him. I mean, what they do is they use statistics to identify Scott Hatterberg or the pitcher named Chad Bradford, who they got, or any number of guys, and they say this is the guy who has the value, the hidden value that we can afford, and I am going to relentlessly pursue the team he plays for until I get that guy. Now, so they don't go into trades with a kind of loose notion of what they want. They're very, very focused about what they want. And this is a big problem for them because Billy Beane has been so successful in the trades he's made in the last 3 or 4 years. He always seems to get so much more than he gives that other teams have become instinctively very wary about doing business with him. So if he wants a guy, he'll often find that the guy is magically not available. So he's had to find all kinds of clever ways to get the players that he wants, because once he wants them, they're not his.
What's a clever way he found?
Well, what he does, he goes fishing. What he'll do. I mean, he did this. There's a long section in the book about a very improbably successful pitcher named Chad Bradford, who's a submariner who throws underhand, basically. Who was in Triple A in the minor leagues with the Chicago White Sox, and who had been just deadly, had been just wiping out opposing hitters, and yet the White Sox were refusing to move him to the big leagues, and Billy knew that if he called the White Sox GM and said, "What do I have to give you to get Chad Bradford?" that the price would have gone up to the point where he didn't want to do it. So instead, what he does is he calls the White Sox GM and he talks about how he has this catcher he might like to move because he needs to get a pitcher who might be a kind of 12th, as he said, a 12th or 13th man on the staff, a guy who might be in the bullpen or might be shuffled between AAA, but someone, he just needed another arm, he said. And he asked the White Sox GM to recommend some names. And the first set of names didn't have Chad Bradford in it. So he goes back to him and says, can you recommend any more guys? And so eventually the White Sox general manager says, well, you know, I hate to even mention him because, you know, he only throws 82 miles an hour, and he's called recently and said his back's not feeling so good, but there's this guy named Chad Bradford who's in AAA. And Billy, you know, says, oh, he'll do.
One last question. Since the Billy Beane approach to signing new players takes into account talents that they have or abilities that they have that other people haven't really noticed. Once they join the A's, that talent does get noticed, therefore they become more valuable, therefore another team might want to sign them, therefore the A's might not be able to afford to keep them anymore, or the player might just, you know, because the player might demand a higher salary that the A's can't match. So have they already lost players, or do you think they're in danger of losing players because the players have become more valuable?
Oh, that's a great question. It's completely true. I mean, let's take an example. Jason Giambi, who they identified as an amateur player and drafted in the second round, who they identified as a good natural hitter, but he didn't actually have a lot of power, didn't hit a lot of home runs, and then comes to the A's and develops into this slugger. And the way baseball is structured is that a team that drafts a player basically has him as an indentured servant for the first 3 years of his career. The second 3 years is a kind of negotiation called arbitration, where they get him at below his market value. But at the seventh year, he can auction his services. He can become a free agent. And Jason Giambi did just this after the 2001 season. And he ended up getting about $120 million from the New York Yankees for 7 years. And the A's didn't even begin to compete for him. I mean, they pretended in the media as if they wanted to re-sign him, but they knew that if they invested this kind of money in a single player, they were putting the entire franchise at risk. It would be in violation of Billy Beane's first rule of management: don't put yourself in a position where one bad contract can ruin your future.
Has he done as well with the Yankees as he did with the A's?
The interesting thing is that when he left at the end of 2001. Everybody was saying, this proves that poor teams can't compete. This proves that the A's are doomed. Now they've lost one of their stars to free agency. They had won 102 games in 2001. They came back without Jason Giambi in 2002 and won 103 games. What they understand is that that superstars can be replaced. If you understand what exactly it was that they contributed to your baseball team, you can often go and find those pieces in other players and reconfigure the team so that it is just as successful without him as it was with him. And you try to replicate the team you had, the aggregate statistics you had, with the star on the team. So it may mean moving a couple of other, replacing three players and upgrading the team in other places. But they've done this now over and over again, and they will, you're right, continue to lose stars, but it looks like they can survive it.
Well, Michael Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Lewis's new book is Moneyball. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.